We're going to get started now. For those of you who haven't been here before, thanks for coming to Blue Stockings tonight. We are a collectively owned, volunteer-operated activist center, cafe, and bookstore. We are open every day. We have an event pretty much every single night. If you'd like to find out about the other things we have going on, you can sign up for our mailing list at the counter. We also have two books by two of the panelists tonight at the counter for sale as well, so you can pick that up after. I'm sure they wouldn't mind signing them for you if you'd like. To keep these events going every night, and we do ask for a $5 donation at every one. It is a suggested donation, so if you don't have $5, anything you can give will be very much appreciated. And let's give a warm welcome.
Or it's here. You're going to move it in?
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. We put this panel together to talk about how mass incarceration, political prisoners, immigrant detention, and the war on terror are all basically pieces of the same puzzle, because we tend to think of them as totally separate issues. People who are dealing with mass incarceration issues often aren't dealing with the war on terror or immigrant detention. People who are working around political prisoners often aren't looking at how tactics used in the war on terror are the same tactics that are used against political prisoners, or what immigrant detention has to do with, you know, the war on terror. Oops. The war on terror. I wanted to put this panel together to kind of like reflect all of that. to kind of give people a broad overview as to like all of these different aspects of what basically is the same type of repression going on. So I'm going to start with a brief overview of mass incarceration and the history that's led up to this wonderful phenomenon that we have today in the U.S. So as of the middle of 2008, there are over 2.3 million people in federal or state prisons or in local jails. There are over 5 million people on parole or probation. And this means that there are over 7.3 million people under some form of correctional supervision. This translates to about 3.2% of all adults in the U.S., or one in every 31 adults. This does not include people in immigrant detention, and I don't think it includes people who are sort of imprisoned under the war on terror that aren't necessarily considered U.S. adult residents. So this is 7.3 million people under some form of state control. Unless you think that there are just 7.3 million people who did bad things and should be locked away from society, there's a context to this, which is that imprisonment has been used as a form of social control of certain populations. In the South, I'm going to go back to the 19th century. In the South, right after the Civil War abolished slavery, the South instituted what they called black codes, which criminalized a range of activities such as vagrancy, being outside after a certain hour, absence from work, and possession of a firearm, but only when the person was involved was black. If you were white and you were a vagrant, or you were outside after a certain hour, or you were absent from work, or you had a gun, you were fine. The black codes also changed the seriousness of a crime. So after slavery, when large numbers of newly freed black people stole to survive, petty thievery became a felony. So before that, if you stole to survive, you know, you were fine. And this drastically changed the nature and the color of who went to prison. In Alabama, prior to the abolition of slavery, 99% of Alabama's prisoners were white. Shortly after the black codes were instituted, the overwhelming majority of people in Alabama's prisons were black. This was not, again, because white people stopped committing crimes, it's just that their actions weren't criminalized, whereas black people were picked up for any number of little things. The same happened in Mississippi and Georgia. Between 1874 and 1877, the imprisonment rate for black people in those states increased 300%. In the South as well, the southern states replaced the system of slavery with the convict leasing system. So basically, they replaced the loss of free labor with another way to gain free black labor, which was that they leased out convicts. The state would imprison black people for actions large and small, they would criminalize actions of black people, and then they would send them off to do hard labor for private corporations. So in Mississippi, black people were returned to the plantations to do plantation work, and in Alabama, convict lessees worked in the coal mines. lest you think that, you know, this just happened in the South. In the North, in non-slave states, incarceration was the primary means of controlling and subordinating the black populations, both before and after the Civil War. Before the Civil War, black people were arrested and convicted at higher rates than their white counterparts, and the same thing happened, kept happening after the Civil War was over. Locking people up was also a way to control gender behavior. At the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, when women started moving out of the house to work in factories and work outside the home and started asserting their independence, localities and states actually passed rules that policed gender behavior. So women could be arrested and incarcerated for being drunk, for having premarital sex, for having extramarital sex, or for contracting an STD. And men were not penalized for these same behaviors. So it was only if you were a woman were you penalized and then arrested and incarcerated for these behaviors. And they were sent to what was called reformatories, which meant that they would reform, in quotes, these women until they felt that they could conform to gender norms, which was to be a happy housewife at home. Like, you stay home, you raise children, you keep the house. Not that you go out and you have a life of your own. In addition, under the guise of quote-unquote reform, women who committed actual crimes received longer sentences than their male counterparts. And the start of indeterminate sentencing, which is having a sentence where you don't actually have an end point. You can't actually say, like, in 10 years, I'll be out. In 3 years, I'll be out. But you would get a sentence of, say, 3 years to whenever you're rehabilitated, meant that you would serve at least 3 years and get out when the prison board felt that you had been rehabilitated, was first passed for women convicted of prostitution, because the prison authorities felt that women convicted of prostitution needed extensive retraining to be reformed and able to rejoin society. This retraining didn't include looking at any of the context that forced women into prostitution, so poverty was not examined, violence was not examined, any other factors that drove women into prostitution or other acts were not examined. It was basically, the onus was on the woman herself to, like, be able to sort of rise above her conditions to be able to, you know, achieve some sort of middle-class standard. However, at that same time, the Michigan State Legislature was considering and rejected a proposal for indeterminate sentencing for men because they felt that, you know, men didn't need that kind of retraining and reformation. Lest you think that this all sort of, like, went away, you know, at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. In 1913, Pennsylvania passed the Muncie Act, stating that women convicted of an offense punishable by more than 1 year. So if a woman convicted an offense and she would normally get 2 years, she would get an indeterminate sentence instead. And again, this was her release was predicated on whether or not the prison board felt that she was reformed enough to be able to, you know, rejoin society as, you know, a middle-class housewife. And as late as 1966, courts have upheld this kind of sentencing policy. In 1966, the Superior Court of Pennsylvania stated that women's inherent physical and psychological differences justify differential treatment. Therefore, it was deemed reasonable for women to receive longer sentences, especially because they received more effective rehabilitation while incarcerated. This more effective rehabilitation was basically teaching them how to cook, clean, and sew, do laundry, you know, and basically be able to be a housewife, even if their economic conditions never permitted them to necessarily, like, catch a man who would be able to keep them as a middle-class housewife. Moving up to the present day, mass incarceration began as a response to the social and political movements of its time. In 1965, Lyndon B. Johnson declared a war on crime in response to the growing social and political movements that were happening across the U.S. In 1973, President Nixon vowed to expand that war, and he actively linked crime to the growing civil unrest in the streets. So he started mixing up these two terms so that people would think that, you know, like, if people were rioting, it's because they were criminals, not necessarily because they had actual social, you know, and political grievances. Also that same year, in 1973, the Rockefeller drug laws were passed, which was the first form of mandatory sentencing in the United States. Basically, the Rockefeller drug laws stated that if you were caught with 2 to 4 ounces of our narcotic, you would get 15 years to life if you took it to trial, and the judge wasn't allowed to have any discretion, so he couldn't say, it's your first, you know, it's your first offense, it was a nonviolent offense, it was a small quantity of drugs, you know, you'd be better off in drug treatment instead of in prison. He basically had to send you to prison, and it was the start of mandatory sentencing, and today every state has some form of mandatory sentencing. So this skyrocketed the prison population in New York State. In the 1980s, Reagan declared a war on drugs, which again, you know, targeted poor people and communities of color. And all of these wars came at a time when economic conditions were deteriorating, especially in communities of color. And these wars served to lock poor people away, basically before they could organize and rise up and try to challenge and change social conditions. Today, people of color are overrepresented in the prison system. Lest you think it's just because maybe people of color commit more crimes, I don't know, maybe we're like just more apt to commit crimes. Keep in mind that from the street to the court system, like, people of color are disproportionately targeted and treated differently than their white counterparts. An April 2005 study by the Department of Justice found that African Americans and Latinos are 3 times more likely than white people to be searched, to be arrested, to be threatened, or to be subdued with force when stopped by the police. So they're 3 times more likely to be, you know, to be stopped in the first place, let alone, you know, arrested, harassed, or brutalized. Conversely, when you get to the court system, another study found that in California, 2/3 of the drug treatment slots went to white people, despite the fact that 70% of people with drug sentences in that state were African American. So judges in that state use their discretion to sentence white people to drug treatment slots or alternatives to incarceration, and were more willing to send black people to jail. The number of women in prison is rapidly increasing, both because of mandatory sentencing and the feminization of poverty. Between 1990 and 2000, the number of women in prison has more than doubled, and it continues to grow to this day. So now that I've given you all this lovely, wonderful background of locking people up to control certain populations, I'm going to turn it over to Marlon, who's going to talk about his own experiences with prison.
Thank you. My name is Marlon Peterson. Am I speaking too loud here?
No.
All right. Vicky just gave you some interesting statistics and also the history of the whole incarceration issue. This issue is really intimate to me. But let me premise this by saying something that it'll pique your interest, that I'm here to talk about niggas, wetbacks, and convicts. Because at the end of the day, when these issues arise around mass incarceration, it's an issue that is very, very serious. And I think that at times, while it's necessary to intellectualize the topic, it's important to understand how serious and how much this impacts people on a day-to-day basis. My expertise on this issue comes from real-life experiences, and that, of course, I have an undergraduate degree in criminal justice, but I also have a 10-year sabbatical in the criminal justice system, being I spent 10 years of my life in prison. Coming out of prison, I became part of an organization called Fans for Freedom, who are well represented here, might I say, also on the back. Basically, we're a defense network for and by families of fighting against illegal deportation, things of that nature. Currently, I don't know if you're aware of the current laws that were passed in Arizona. It was just signed a couple days ago regarding giving the law enforcement the ability to stop and detain people who may look like they're illegal immigrants. I don't know what that look is, but that's why I start off by premising by saying that I'm talking here about convicts, wetbacks, and niggas. That's why I started, because that's who they're looking after. This issue of mass incarceration, historically in this country, is nothing more than a racist philosophy that's just, you know, propagated or perpetuated against certain marginalized people. I don't need to tell you that. You know that, so I don't need to just put that in you. But to make it more real to you, I mean, where I've come from, I'm from Brooklyn, New York, born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. And where I was at for all those years in upstate prisons, on Rikers Island, all those sort of things, that's who I was around, people that looked just like me. Not people that look like most of you all in the audience, people that look like me inside is up there. And that's no coincidence. It's no coincidence that this racist law that was passed in Arizona, where it allows people to stop people indiscriminately, arbitrarily, capriciously, just because you look like somebody that might be an immigrant. Interesting statistic in Arizona, there's approximately about 37,000 people in the state in prisons in Arizona. A study in 2007 said that they project an increase about 52% within 10 years of that prison population in Arizona. About 52%. Outpacing the growth of the regular population of the state itself by, I think, about 26%. Who do you think is filling those cells up when they need more money now to fill up those cells for about 10 years from now? You understand what I'm saying? This law that was just recently put into place last week it's just another step in making sure that that projection becomes a reality. You understand? And mentioning wetbacks, and I think it was in 1920, in the New York Times, actually, that's when that term was first mentioned. And the U.S. government made it official, I think, in the 1950s when they declared Operation Wetback, when they sent about a million Mexican illegal people from Mexico and their U.S.-born children back to Mexico in 1 year. 1 million. Think about that. 1 million people sent back to the country in 1 year. 1 year alone. Okay? And what we have in Arizona is something similar. Because that law was for Mexican-looking people. That's the way that law was stipulated in the archives of Congress, the Mexican-looking people. You know, you put that in law and people pass and people say, okay. But now you have another law that says that people sat by and watched this thing get passed here. And while there's a lot of uproar behind it, we see with different people, different advocates, the mere fact that that's something like that was passed is kind of, you know, it's really shocking. You should kind of, I don't want to say scared, but it needs to infect you and impact you. Because it's not something, just because it happened in Arizona, which is somewhere out there in the West, doesn't mean something like that can happen in another state. It sets the precedent. It sets the precedent for things to be passed similarly in other states. And not only against minorities, but other marginalized groups of people. It could be any sort of marginalized group that saw these things can just get their way into the door, and it becomes a law now. You understand? And that projection of, you know, the rise in the Arizona population by about 30,000 within 10 years, these plans are made long in advance. You understand? I think we need to see these things so that, and step in now, so that we can also make our own sort of plans far in advance to counter these sort of things that's happening right now. Interesting enough, also, the person that... the congressman in Arizona that wrote this bill, his name is, I think, is Russell Pierce. He's somebody who was found in 2007 at an anti-immigrant rally, taking a picture with, I think it's J.T. Reed, who is a well-known neo-Nazi group leader. These things are not by coincidence that these people do these sort of things. This is their background. And I think as citizens, people who have the ability to vote, who have ability to advocate, who have the ability to organize along with groups like Family Freedom and so many other groups, you need to be able to know who these people are who are running for these positions. And if they have been in these positions for long, still, what is their history? Because his history, his strength, his power within the Arizona Congress gave him the ability to influence other senators to go along with it, to co-sponsor it. You understand? And his strength and his power there will allow him to influence other senators in other states to follow and draft similar laws. So as I started, I premised by saying something that would kind of shock your attention, would make you listen to me more. Because, you know, you don't usually hear them talk. You're not supposed to say those terms in public, you know? But I knew that it would get your attention because this sort of issues here needs your attention. And it needs your advocacy and it needs your voice in whatever way is possible, whether it be through your school, whether it be through writing, whatever your abilities and accessibilities are, whether it be through social networking, things of these nations need to organize around these issues because I said these people are organizing around these issues too, but just in their own way. Understand? I think with that, thank you for your time and attention.
My name is Laura Whitehorn, and ladder, higher, whatever. And I served 14 years in federal prison for political actions, which I can talk about if people want. I want to add one thing to what you were saying, Marlon, which is that because I lived through the end of the Red Scare, right? And when I was in sixth grade, I said I didn't like a song that they were singing. We had to sing in music class, and the teacher called me a communist. And I went home and I said to my mother, "What's a communist?" And she got really scared because my whole family was communists. But the point I wanted to make about it is that it when you say it sets the precedent, it really does because it drives back our thinking. It sort of begins to make us as a society accept. Oh, and people will say to you, "Oh, things are so bad." We had an event here a few weeks ago about a poster book, and people were talking about why there was no wheat pasting of posters the way there was, you know, in the 70s when I was active on the streets in New York. And people were saying, oh, well, because, you know, you get arrested. And, and then someone else said, wait, on my block, there are no security cameras all the time. What are we talking about? You know, there are still places. So we start to accept the terms as being, as we start to accept the repression. And I want to say one thing about my time in prison and then really get on to the whole bigger question, political prisoners. But one of the things that happens in prison that I think we prisoners learn to resist is that you begin to police yourself. Because you know, you walk into the cafeteria for lunch, and if you don't have your, in the federal system, if you didn't have your shirt tucked in, the lieutenant was going to pull you out of the line, send you to the back of the line, you know, you'd be rushing. And so you'd start to tuck in your shirt, even though you didn't want to. And we used to sort of have to resist policing ourselves. You'd censor yourself, because you knew that if you spoke up, you know, you were going to go to the hole. So people would start censoring themselves. And on a, and I think that what happens in prison, exactly as Vicky was saying, is a microcosm of control in society. And that's the internal part of it. So if we don't fight this stuff as it comes down and talk to people, talk to your neighbors, talk to the people who assume that illegal immigrants are a terrible thing, as if anyone could really, a human being could really be illegal, then we're starting to repress ourselves. So the way that that ties in with the question of political prisoners, I think, is what Vicky started with, as prisons as social control. And so when I was active in, I was in the Weather Underground, I got organized by the Black Panther Party in the 60s. I was an anti-war person, and in those days, the streets really were, I mean, active. People all over society. There aren't too many people here old enough to remember that. But it was, things were dividing line issues. You know, there was all, no one, you wouldn't talk to someone about Vietnam and they'd say, oh, I don't know what I think of the war. People had a position. And the gross incarceration that we've seen has come after that. The other thing is that there were political prisoners back then. There were the five Puerto Rican nationalists who had fought for the independence of Puerto Rico who got out in 78, 79. There were already Black Panthers in prison right from the beginning, the Panther 21, who were accused of a plan to bomb the botanical gardens and all this other stuff, and they were in prison for several years, and when the jury finally got the case, they acquitted them in 45 minutes. And the things that were done in political cases then are exactly what people are going to be talking about that are being done to Fahad Hashmi and other Muslim prisoners today. And the point about it is that any time we ignore what's being done in the prisons, because the people that it's being done to are people that you would think, oh, well, you know, they broke the law, they knew what they were doing. In my case, I bombed the Capitol. You know, no one was hurt, but it's still, you're not supposed to bomb the U.S. Capitol. And anything that gets done to those people then gets used. We were just talking about, in my case, the resistance conspiracy case in Washington, D.C. We had to fight for months, and I can't really remember whether we won or lost. The government had us in a courtroom where there was a bulletproof glass wall between us and the spectators. And, you know, I want to say guilty as charged, put up a security wall or something like that. Anonymous juries began. I was held in preventive detention. They said it was too dangerous to let out on any bail, even though I had no, I had no murders in my charges. At the time that they held me in preventive detention, I think I had possession of guns and false identification documents. And yet, I was held on preventative detention. And now, it's you know, what's the phrase, de rigueur? It's like what's done all the time. So that's something. And the book that was mentioned is The War Before, and it's the writings of Safia Boukhari, who was also a political prisoner. And I want to say, most of the political prisoners and the ones who are still in after 40 years are Black, and were part of the Black rebellions of the 60s and 70s. And I just wanted to read one thing that Safia wrote because it was exactly what Marlon and Vicky were talking about. She says, one of the things I've been involved in is trying to make sure that that we can defend our communities against being victimized by the legal system. We have to make sure it doesn't happen in the first place, because it's hard to get people out of prison once they're in. while you're waiting for someone to find out you really didn't do what they're charged, what they've charged you with doing, you could get a case while you're in there. So you can get killed before you get out of there, or psychologically damaged for life. Our black young men have been going through, have enough going against them without the psychological trauma of being incarcerated at 12, 13, 14 years of age. And that's the age at which they're being incarcerated today. The other thing is to deal with rooting out the systemic racism that infests our justice system. We can't get a fair trial in this system for black people because we're already stereotyped. Whatever we're accused of, we did it. If you get indicted, you did it. And if you got killed for doing it, then you did it. And if you didn't do it this time, you did it another time. So if you didn't do it this time, you're caught for what you did last week or the week before. So now you're doing time for that. And that's true no matter who you are in America, if you're black. And I would say she wrote that back in, I think, 1990 or the end of the 80s. And she was a Black Panther, and so the Panthers had a program against incarceration. And that has become even more true today of Muslims and immigrants. And I think that we have to look at the ways that everything that was done to political prisoners, and by that I mean people who are incarcerated because they're part of political movements, either took actions as part of those movements, as I did, or were just targeted for being part of those movements and were framed, like Mumia Abu-Jamal, that anything that got done to us is now being done on a more massive level. And one last part of it was the Lexington Control Unit and Marion Control Units, which were started for political prisoners, where political prisoners, for their politics, were put into these control units where they never saw the light of day. Two of my co-defendants were in one of them until it was shut down by the attention from Amnesty International and a lot of church groups. And they were never alone in their, they were alone in their cells, but they had cameras on at all times. And so you had no privacy. And I think that's, Jean's going to talk about that when she talks about what's happened to Fahad, because I think it's very similar. So I just think, in closing my part, that we have to look at all the parts of it together, but we have to start to build a different consciousness in this country, that control is not the way to build a better society, that every knee-jerk law that comes in, you know, someone pushes a bus over, say, and all of a sudden it becomes a class A 29 felony to push over a bus, and they're HIV, I work in HIV. Someone, a man infected some women without telling them that he was HIV positive and he had unprotected sex, and all of a sudden every state in this country just about has these insane laws about it's illegal to have sex with someone if you have HIV, even with a condom in some states. So those are the things that we have to try to start breaking open and work together on it, because all the issues are combined and together they spell trouble.
Thank you. I'm Ravi Ragbir, and I'm, as Manan said, we both from Families for Freedom, which is an organization that deals with those facing detention. Those who are in detention facing deportation. Just the mere fact that you need to understand when someone is in detention, they're not charged with anything. They are just placed there because of who they look like or who they are, just being undocumented or just being an immigrant. Let me step back. We say war in Afghanistan, war in Iraq, war on drugs, war on terror, war on immigrants. Right? It's all about war, and it's about good, bad. So now, not just being who I am, I'm a bad guy. As you can tell, I'm an immigrant. And I'm a bad guy, so I am taking something away from you. I am now a person that you have to get rid of, or you have to focus your attention on. And not just say you have to look at me, but you have to do something to me. And that's what it's doing to you. It's, we are living in fear, but you are being controlled. If you cannot walk the street now, you may think that you are living in a nice suburban area or a nice area where you don't have any crime and all of these things. Recently, there was a murder out in New Jersey, and all you could hear was, "This is a nice place. Nothing like this ever happens." And I'm all scared. I'm fearing. I do not know what to do. Because you have been trained, you've been controlled, you are pawns now to that they can direct and they can lead you to their agenda. And what is that agenda? That agenda is really getting rid of me. You have 33,000 immigrants in detention every day right now. Over 389,000 being deported in 1 year. The last year, Marlon spoke about 1 million of Mexicans getting deported in 1 year. Well, it may be as bad as that because the figures from ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, are really messed up. So I don't believe anything they say. So if they say 389, I would add another 150,000 numbers to that. So if in 2 years you have deported 1 million people going through the system, how can you have someone going through detention, going through jail, and getting 1 million people out immediately? Something has to be wrong. Where is the judicial review? Where is the judicial oversight that can say, that can look and say, this, something is wrong? Laura and Marlon and Vicky spoke about mandatory. Everything is mandatory. Mandatory sentencing, mandatory jail, mandatory removal, mandatory detention. Everything is mandatory. It's taken out of your hands. It doesn't make you feel better that it's taken out of your hands? Do you think you're safer? Of all these laws, of all these you've heard of massive incarceration of millions of people, are you feeling safer? And if you answer that question, the answer would be no. I'm afraid to walk at night. I'm afraid to go in certain areas. I'm afraid to be on email and give my name out because I don't know who may be stalking me later. I'm afraid. And that fear is what controls us. And that fear is what is being used to control you. Now, I didn't want to go into this philosophical thing, and I apologize for that, because you have to know that is philosophy is one thing, but reality is my going into detention, my facing deportation, the fact that I can be snatched, and my community, my fellow immigrants can be snatched, even though you have done nothing wrong. You're working one job, you're working two jobs, you're working three jobs. They will come into your homes. They will come into your homes at 3 o'clock in the morning, banging on your door, not breaking the door, but brushing through the house in boots, armed with assault rifles, body armor, pointing their guns at kids, asking, "Where is your dad?" Who is sleeping in the next room? "Where is your dad?" But you cannot. They're telling the kid, "Do not move." 5-year-old kids, 4-year-old kids. That is a reality that we have to face in this community. That is what our kids are facing when they come in to pick up an undocumented immigrant who is working. They come with helicopters and assault rifles. Where is the justice in that? How can you say that this is fair? How can you say that that person who has been taken away, that father who has been taken away from his sons and daughters, taken away and then sent into oblivion because they are not told where they're going. They're not told, the family is not told how to get in touch with them. The person doesn't know how to call or doesn't know. You have to battle, you have to go to war with them to get the smallest resources. You're shipped down to, you're caught in New York, you're shipped to Arizona, you're shipped to Alabama. I was shipped to Alabama. Spent a year in Alabama, where the nearest building was a mile and a half, 2 miles away. Building, we're not talking about somewhere reasonable that we, you know, New York City is, you know, like, open up a building like a shack. What happens? I don't have access to lawyers. My family was in New York. My friends were in New York. My consulate is in New York. Everything that I needed to have to fight my case was removed from me. So Laura is talking about control. Laura is talking about how we are, how it's how we, they manipulate, they want to win, and they will win at any cost. And you think that you may not be the, we are the targets, but you are controlled. And that control also, I would like to say that it is also to divert attention to what they're really doing. And we won't go into that, that's a different subject. But let's talk, when we say the war on terror, the war on immigrants, wrapped around the war on terror, so that now you're not just undocumented, but you're terrorists coming in from the border. We're talking about mothers. And when you hear the stories of mothers who are going through the Rio Grande, losing their kids while who are holding in their arms, losing their children to the river, you think they are terrorists? Right? So we are now not just immigrants, but we are terrorists. And it is so pervasive that even when you have legal recourse, like Hashmi's sister-in-law, she was able to file for her green card. Now it would normally take 6 months because she was married to a US citizen who was Hashmi's brother. But because of Hashmi's relationship to the woman, the sister-in-law, it took her five years to get something that would normally happen in a few months. And that's what we face. When our immigrant brother in Los Angeles, Alex Sanchez, was fighting against gang violence and for the immigrant community, guess what? He was incarcerated and his bail was set at $2 million. $2 million. Not just, you got to put up houses, etc., etc., etc. I will end because you have to understand, I will end on that note, because even though we may think that the war on immigrant doesn't include political prisoners, it does end up on political prisoners. It does speak to the fact that we now become pawns in this political process. Thank you.
Good evening. So I'm going to talk about a case tonight that's happening right here in New York City that's going to trial in 2 days. And then in the question and answer, if we wanted to talk more broadly about the war on terror and the kind of larger kind of incarceration kind of at the heart of the war on terror, we could do that. But I just wanted to take a few minutes and just talk about the specific case, and then we can open it up. As I think all of the panelists have talked about, I think what is at the heart of all of these kind of aspects of incarceration, and certainly about the incarceration that I'm going to talk about, is the politics of fear. And the ways that fear, I think, makes us give up certain things, right? So sometimes my friends and I joke around that Richard Reed, do people know who Richard Reed is?
Obama.
Exactly. One of the most powerful men in the country, right? Because
take our shoes off.
Yeah, exactly. We've all been taking our shoes off for 7 years, right? But it's the politics of fear, right? That one guy, you know, tries to set his shoes on fire, doesn't even manage to, right? Means that all of us take our shoes off for years, right? That's about fear. And I think everybody on the panel has kind of echoed, like, the ways that we become controlled by that, and we come to accept we're going to give up these certain things and we're going to get security, or we're going to get safety, or we're going to get any number of things, except what we know is that we don't really, but... So I wanted to talk about a case of actually a former student of mine, and just to give you a little, so Vicky actually is also a former student of mine, so it's very humbling to be like on a panel with Vicky and her awesome book. But this is another student of mine. I'm a professor at Brooklyn College, and I teach in a political science department, but my own work is in race and African American studies. And so in 2002, I had a young man in a seminar I taught on civil rights, and it was a seminar that was from the 1960s to the present, sort of post-civil rights racial politics, and he wrote a paper on, this is 2002, on the ways that Muslim American groups were finding their sort of civil liberties being abridged sort of in the wake of 9/11. Right? And he writes this paper, and his name is Syed Fahad Hashmi. And I think probably many of you know that Syed Fahad Hashmi is now sitting in the Metropolitan Correctional Center and has been there for 3 years in severe solitary confinement before trial. So I think part of for me, I think as a professor of civil rights, there's something very humbling about sort of teaching about civil rights and then right down, you know, basically, you know, a couple miles away, there sits, you know, a student I was teaching about civil rights whose own civil rights have been really violated. And so there are three kind of issues, civil rights issues, that I wanted to mention in terms of his case and that I think are incredibly important. The first is, well, let me step back. He is being charged with material support to Al-Qaeda, right? Politics of fear. All you have to do is say the word Al-Qaeda and we're really, you know, we're going to give up our shoes, we're going to give up our coats, we're going to do anything, right? Because that, it's such a fearsome sounding word. So 4 counts of material support to Al-Qaeda. He's not actually being charged with being a member of Al-Qaeda. He's not being charged with having any direct contact with Al-Qaeda or of actually helping in any specific plot or action of Al-Qaeda, right? And this is possible by what are called material support laws, which get instituted actually under Clinton and then expanded under the Patriot Act. And basically, material support laws are kind of predicated on the idea that you have to prevent crime before it happens, right? Which in many ways is sort of goes against a lot of the precepts, right, of our justice system, which is that you actually have to have committed a crime to be charged with a crime, right? What material support does is it makes it a crime to do anything that they can say is knowing support to a group that's been deemed a foreign terrorist organization. So that doesn't mean there has to be any criminal act has actually happened. And in fact, because they're all about preventing criminal acts, it's actually, if a criminal act hasn't happened, it's all the better, right? Because look, it's effective. So again, he's being charged with 4 counts of material support. And the centerpiece of the case, and will be the testimony of a cooperating witness, a man by the name of Junaid Babar, who is also is from Queens. Hashmi grew up in Flushing, Queens, went to Robert Wagner High School, and then went to Brooklyn College, graduated from Brooklyn College, got his master's at London Metropolitan University. So a Queens from Flushing comes to London, asks to stay with him for a couple weeks. In early 2004, what the government alleges and what Babar is going to testify about, the government claims that Babar had in his suitcase raincoats, ponchos, and waterproof socks, what the government is calling military gear, raincoats, ponchos, and waterproof socks. So we all have raincoats and ponchos tonight. So, and that he had those in his, Babar had those in his suitcase in Hashmi's apartment. And that Babar then went on to Pakistan and ultimately delivers these materials, allegedly, to the third-ranking member of Al-Qaeda in South Waziristan, Pakistan. And then the government also claims that Babar borrowed Hashmi's cell phone and then used it to call other conspirators and other terrorist plots. So that is what he's being charged with. And I think there are three crucial issues at the kind of heart of this case, which is why we have to be sort of concerned, and I think everybody on the panel has kind of raised the ways that these larger rights issues, I think, underline all of these different aspects of incarceration. And I think the first is conditions of confinement, the conditions in jails and prisons. And again, Hashmi is 3 years in severe solitary confinement under what are called special administrative measures. They sound kind of boring. But what they actually do is they basically almost completely close off the communication of a prisoner. They were originally begun in 1996 and aimed at high-level sort of mafia and gang leaders who could kind of commit violence with their word from inside of prison. After the terrorist attack in 9/11, they get expanded. But basically what they do is they prevent any communication with the prisoner in the outside world. So, for instance, he is not allowed to write or receive letters except from his immediate family, and he can only write them one letter a week on 3 pages. Right? So, again, serial killers get letters. The detainees on Guantanamo Bay get letters. Right? But no letters. He is under 24-hour electronic surveillance inside and outside of his cell, which means every movement that he makes is under camera, which obviously means that he showers and goes to the bathroom in front of the camera. He is allowed 1 hour of exercise a day, but again, because of these rules, he doesn't get to exercise. If people know, at the exercise facility at MCC does have fresh air, but he is not allowed to exercise there, so he has no fresh air, and he basically exercises in another sort of small, kind of solitary, you know, cage-like room. So that's the first issue, is these are pre-trial conditions of confinement, right? And I think, as everybody on the panel has mentioned, we're just getting more, this kind of practice of confinement is getting more and more routinized, more and more regular. The second issue is the issue of secret evidence, classified evidence. I think many of us, I think, are only now becoming aware of the fact that you can actually go to court, in a federal courtroom, and there can be evidence in your own case that you cannot see, that you cannot review, right? So contrary to sort of eighth grade civics, right, where part of being an American citizen is that you have the right to review the evidence against you, to confront your accuser. In fact, much of the evidence in this case, and unfortunately in other cases, is classified, which means that he's not been allowed to review it. His lawyers went through a CIA-level clearance to review it, but they can't talk about it with him. So obviously it makes it very hard to prepare a defense, a full and fair defense. So that's the second issue, sort of due process issues. The third is First Amendment issues. Fahad was, and it was when he was a student at Brooklyn College, very politically active, very politically outspoken, a member of the New York group Al-Mahajirun. You know, he came to the attention of both federal authorities and the media. He's sort of articles in Time and CNN in 2002, sort of quote him, calling the United States the biggest terrorist in the world, calling him a potential homegrown threat. And the government is preparing to use, and has gotten the okay from the court, from the judge, to use his political statements in court as evidence of intent, right? Despite, again, what we know is a First Amendment that protects speech, right? And if you protect speech, you have to protect all sorts of speech, right? And yet they are going to use his constitutionally protected speech in court. So these are sort of crucial issues, both in his case, which is happening literally down the street at 500 Pearl Street. It is going to trial on Wednesday, and the trial will probably last 2 to 3 weeks. So this is sort of, you know, I wrote an article in The Nation about a year ago now, and I called it Guantanamo at Home, because I think one of the things that we haven't been as aware of is the ways that what happened in the prison in Cuba, what's happened in prison, you know, in Abu Ghraib and Bagram, has unfortunately not been just these overseas places, but in fact here in the United States. And I think that what made Guantanamo possible was a larger sort of problem, which is this kind of politics of fear and this kind of giving up of, you know, being willing to sort of seek this, like, you know, control and sort of seeking this sort of security. And what we traded, right, was, well, we'll just trade these sort of set of civil liberties. And so, again, we can talk more about the larger politics, but again, maybe it's time to open it up.
Before we open it up to questions, I know that Ravi and Marlon or Families for Freedom is doing a press conference tomorrow. I know that Jean has some news about, you know, what's going on with Fahad's case starting on Wednesday.
I want to support those, okay. Both those.
You know, so I wanted to sort of like ask you guys like what people can do sort of immediately in the short term and maybe longer term to get involved. You know, if you want to talk about political prisoners. So I don't know, come wrestle for who goes first.
Do you want me to go first? Or do you want to?
Okay. Yeah.
So there are a couple of things that you can do, if both in the specific case and then in the larger issues. The trial is open. And so people are allowed to go and to watch and to observe. And so if you want to go and watch and observe, the trial will be held at 500 Pearl Street, which is the federal courthouse, in front of Judge Loretta Preska. I don't know if people have ever gone to a federal courthouse or a federal... the things you need to be aware of is they will take... Like, you have to turn in your cell phone. You cannot bring laptops. You cannot wear buttons or T-shirts or anything that have political messages on them. So, again, that we expect the trial to last 2 to 3 weeks, and it's very important... I mean, in this case, but in many, in these cases, for them not to happen in a vacuum and not to happen sort of outside of the...
Can I answer? How many people have attended a trial? Okay, if you haven't, do it. For two reasons, I would say. One is because it will teach you more about what we're talking about than anything, you know, than hearing it all. And number two, this is a chance to stand up, to go to... That trial is a chance to say, okay, I'm not afraid. Not only that, but I do care that our civil liberties are being abridged. So I just want to sort of like underline what you're saying about people going to that trial.
Right. And then the second thing we're asking people to do is, one of the things, as I mentioned, is that he's not allowed to get mail. And so one of the ways we've been sort of trying to dramatize sort of some of the issues of his confinement. First, we had a campaign where we wrote letters directly to him. They were mostly sent back. We are now writing postcards that are addressed to him, but we are mailing them to Attorney General Holder to kind of, you know, basically kind of, you know, hold Attorney General Holder accountable for this kind of system of confinement. And so I have postcards tonight. This has been a big campaign in the past couple of weeks, and you know, so if you could sign a postcard tonight, that would be it. And, you know, I know people work during the day, so coming to the trial might be hard. We do also every Monday night for the next, during the trial, for the next 3 weeks, we will be holding vigils on Monday evenings from 6 to 7 outside of MCC. MCC is right behind the federal courthouse. It is 150 Park Row. So we are having vigils outside the prison just to kind of bear witness to what's happening. So again, I know with people who work during the day, that might work with your schedule better. So again, three things: coming to the trial, signing a postcard, which I will pass around in a second, and then coming to the Monday evening vigils outside of MCC, which is right behind the federal courthouses. Thank you.
One other thing I wanted to add, Jean mentioned no cell phones, no laptops, no buttons, no political things. Also, for those of you who've never been to court, no pepper spray, no knives, no guns, nothing that could be construed as a weapon, because it will get confiscated, you know, from you, and you just kind of don't want to go through that. And I don't know if that could then be used later on as like, oh, Fahad's supporters came and brought weapons.
Right. Thank you.
One of the things the Arizona law says is that you have to walk with ID everywhere you go to prove your status and prove who you are. You also asked to show ID at this courthouse. So maybe as a stance, when you go in there, you do not want to show ID. You want to go in there. You're going to be bucking the system. It depends on what you're willing to do. I don't know how you feel about that, but, you know, it's one way to make a stand. What we, in response to Arizona, you know, Armada spoke about it. You've been hearing it on the news because this is a really horrendous law. And in response to Arizona, we're having a press conference tomorrow in front of Federal Plaza because we need to keep this focus on Arizona. We need to let Arizona know that you cannot have this type of law without accountability. So we're going to have that press conference tomorrow at 12 o'clock in front of Federal Plaza, 26 Federal Plaza. You're urged to come out. You're urged to start writing letters to Governor Brewer. Saying that you think it's a wrong thing, it's a terrible thing, and she should look to repeal this act, and also be continually aware that we are going to have more and more actions like this against that type of system. So,
just to backtrack a little bit from what you were saying before, I think. If folks are undocumented or know people who are undocumented, you don't necessarily want to go to federal court and not show an ID or go at all for that matter. So that's just a caution.
Right. I assume that was understood, but yes. we immigrants have to be careful where we walk. I had a meeting at a Jewish building, and I was going with a priest, and we had this meeting, and we had to go through the scanner, we had to go through the checks, and he had a bread knife in there. Created problems in a regular building, and they confiscated a bread knife because it could have been a dangerous weapon. Anyhow, back to what you need to do, which is this press conference, and continue to be looking at the listservs and the bulletins about what's next. What's next with Hashmi? What's next with the immigrant fight? What's next with the incarceration drug war on drugs fight? So continue to be aware and stand in support of repealing and making those changes.
Oh. And I just have a press release that Fans for Freedom has released to different media outlets throughout the state, as well as the country, that we have a copy of it as well, if you're interested in looking at it, as well as some opportunities for you to organize around the issue as well. So you can pass that out to all, give it to whoever's interested in taking it with them.
And just, I think these are the burning issues right now. So, I tell your friends to go to that trial and to go to that press conference. But around political prisoners too, there's actually a list in here in this book of all the current political prisoners from the different movements, from mostly the Black movement, but also anti-imperialists like me, white anti-imperialists, Puerto Rican independentistas, etc. And many of them, there are six who are right here in New York State. And New York State prisons, you can visit. I mean, when I got off parole, the first thing I did was go to visit Herman Bell, who's in prison. Because when you're on parole, you're not allowed to, federal parole, you're not allowed to go to a prison. You can go into a New York State prison with a driver's license. I mean, they don't have visiting lists like in the feds. You have to get on a list. It's much more open. And these people are part of our community. I mean, they're old. They're like me. They're not your age. But they've been struggling for many years, and they have a lot to talk about and a lot to teach and a lot to hear from you. So I write to them and look for the campaigns for political prisoners' freedom and like that. But I would think that if any of the political prisoners and former political prisoners were sitting here now, they would say focus on the immigration issue, focus on the detention of immigrants, and focus on the bogus war on terror. And I would just say that, again, we were called terrorists. Now, terrorism, that's another thing. I always talk about this with people because people use it all the time, terrorists. A terrorist is someone who uses terror, who uses armed attacks on civilians to force a government to do something. So 9/11 was a terrorist attack. But it has begun to be used for any violent act that is done by anyone who is not part of the government. So it's any non-governmental militancy, even. It doesn't even have to be violent. And if you think back on it, what was the Constitution, what was this country about? You know, it was about the fact that people have a right to take up arms when their government is illegitimate. And in my case, what we said is our government is illegitimate because it's doing stuff like this. And so therefore, I'm not encouraging anyone to do anything. All I'm saying is that when you hear someone use the word terrorist, ask them what they mean. It's being used as part of, like Bobby was saying, of instilling fear in a way that when you go through an airport checkpoint, I see people looking around them in this suspicious way, as if other people around them are going to be, quote, terrorists. And so it's just a really part of how the language gets changed. And then the thinking gets changed, and then we've lost our ability to struggle. Sorry, I sort of bogarted that.
Questions?
I just wanted to ask if anybody on the panel can talk about the Supermax prisons and the resistance against them, because as Gene and I and Brian, we've been working on Hod's case, you know, more and more of these cases, people end up in Florence.
I can start.
Yeah, if you want, I'm beginning to think that the next logical step with Fahad's case is to start organizing on the Supermax.
Right.
Because they legalize all
these. Yeah, exactly. And Supermaxes are, I mean, it is part of the punish more, control more. It started with Marion Penitentiary when that was locked down in, I don't know, the 70s, I think. And then Florence was built. And in Florence, and I just have to say, having been under some of those conditions, not the 24-hour cameras, but things like the constant pat searches by men and the inability to protect your privacy and all that, it wears on you. It has a lasting impact on your psyche. And so it's not just like, oh, okay, for 3 years you're up against those conditions, but then if you get out, you know, it's over. It's not like that. People are damaged by it. So the Supermaxes, there is a campaign, a national campaign, which the American Friends Service Committee is part of. It's called Stop Supermax. And part of it was to educate the public about the forms of torture that are going on in the prison system, because that kind of isolation is internationally recognized as torture. Having the lights on all night and all day is recognized as torture. There are many parts of it. People do not, in Florence, have no actual contact with other people except when they're chained up. And then those conditions then get expanded to other prisons, so that there's a group of political prisoners, the San Francisco 8. In California, the case is almost over. It's been pretty much won because it was a bogus case. But two of the men, Herman Bell and Jaleel Muntakim, were taken from New York State prisons where they had been in general population for 35 years. And they were in San Francisco jail, and when you visited them, they had to be chained behind glass while you were visiting them. And the Supermaxes are more and more what states are building them too. It's sort of, and every time you read about Supermaxes, you will see they are for the worst of the worst. And even the liberal journalists will say, well, the Supermax prisons were started for the worst of the worst. So what do you think of them? You think of an axe murderer who killed 89,000 babies. And, you know, the worst of the worst is anyone who offended a warden someplace and got put in isolation and then sent out. And in fact, the man who people may have known as H. Raff Brown, now Jaleel Al-Amin, is in Florence. He was a state prisoner, never did anything. All of a sudden he ends up in Florence, largely because he's now a Muslim. So it's a coming together of the issue of you know, the war on Muslims and the heightening prison control. And I think people can find information about it by Googling Stop Supermax and AFSC. And just, they're connected with the other part of what's happening, especially in the federal system, is communications management units. And it's part of what Jean was talking about the special administrative measures. These are all means of controlling communication. And because some of the Muslim prisoners do not use English as their first language, the federal prison system felt threatened by them having phone calls with their family. So they are only permitted phone calls during certain hours when there can be a translator on. And what's ironic about it is there's at least one, if not other, English as first language speaking political prisoners in those units too. And they too can only make calls during the time when a translator is on. So you see that it's just, you know, it's a way of increasing that kind of control, and it damages people for life.
Other questions?
I would like to know how I can get the information about the site of the prisons in the U.S., where is the location, and I would like to know where is the location and how many people are both there.
Prisons?
Yeah, you know the location?
You just mean the location of prisons in the United States in general?
Yes, and I would like to know how the impact these sites has in the communities.
Well, I mean, the quick answer is say you can just Google United States prisons, you can find those sort of stats, but...
And do you have one map, like a U.S. map, and you have location?
No.
Yeah, because it's all different states.
It's all different states. So I'll give you how it impacts communities. I'll just give you a brief synopsis of that. Let's take New York State, for instance, right, where there's about 60-some-odd prisons, men and women facilities in New York State. Prisons. That's discounting county jails in Rikers Island, those sort of things. These are just state facilities, women and men facilities, where...
New York State.
Excuse me?
You talk about New York State.
New York State, correct.
So where is located?
Well, they're located up in the northern regions of New York State. All right? That's where the majority, if not all of the New York State facilities are located. The interesting numbers you mentioned about how it impacts communities, well, interesting statistic that mentions that approximately about 85% of people who are in these prisons in New York State come from five neighborhoods in New York City. Just from five neighborhoods in New York City, a lot of Bed-Stuy, Crown Heights, South Bronx, South Jamaica, Queens.
No, my question is, you said the location
is northern region of New York. Anywhere
that's... How these sites affect the community around?
Oh, she wants to know how it affects the community.
The jails, the community is ran by these jails, meaning that... All right, the communities are ran by the jails. For instance, like I mentioned, the majority of people in this prison are black and Latino people. But the majority of people who work in these prisons, whether it be as correction officers, administrators, cooks, wardens, teachers, nurses, doctors, what have you, are people that live in that community. So let's take a community, let's say like Clinton County, where there's Clinton Correctional Facility. That's about 15, 20 minutes away from Canada. All right? Now, the majority of people that work in that facility in those different positions that I mentioned just now are people who live in that community. So if that prison is not there, those people don't have a job. So that prison fuels the economy of that particular community. Also, we are dealing with the census this year, the annual 10-year census. Now, as some of you may or may not know, that the people in those counties, the way they tabulate their statistics in those counties by counting people who are incarcerated as members of that particular community. And that way, because part of filling out the census so that you can get federal money from the federal government into your community based on, one of the things based on population of your particular community. So if you extract, let's say, one facility, let's say Green Haven, which is in, I think, Dutchess County, right, there's about 2,500 people in that prison. You take 2,500 people out, that's 2,500 less people on that particular Dutchess County's census. So that's less money that Dutchess County would get. But you put them there and you keep them there, or you continue to, you increase the population of these particular prisons in these upstate and northern communities, well, they get more money. So therefore, the monies that the majority of people come from New York City. So the monies that would usually be given to New York City to help fund different issues from education to home shelters to what have you doesn't go to New York City. It goes up to those prisons because those people who were originally located and lived in New York City, who committed crimes in New York City or for whatever were arrested in New York City, are not counted as part of the census of those counties where they're just incarcerated in those facilities, in those counties. So, it's, you know, that's a big, you know, kind of like follow the money trail type situation.
Yeah, so you said to me the employee of this facility, they live in the close community, no?
They live, it's not close. Let me break it down for you. Like, let's say you have this area right here, just Low East Side,
yeah.
Correct?
Uh-huh.
Low East Side of Manhattan. Now, if you had a prison in, was a prison not too far, this is a prison not too far from here. Now, let's just say that prison was the only business here. It was the only business. And everybody who lived in this community worked in that particular prison. So everybody's mortgages, everybody's car notes, everybody's money paying for their children's scholarships are funded by the people who are incarcerated in that facility.
Just to be the professor on the panel, one of the books that I think is sort of the best kind of introduction to this idea that Marlon's talking about the prison industrial complex and the ways that communities become dependent on the money from these prisons, is Christian Parenti's Lockdown America. It's really well written and readable, but it lays this out step by step how this works. So I would recommend it as a kind of, I mean, there are lots of really good books, but the Lockdown America is just very it's just very readable, and but it's very detailed. So, like, I think that would be a good place to start, that kind of lays out kind of what Marlon has been talking about. So I would recommend Lockdown America by Christian Parenti.
Yes.
I didn't know about this Stop Supermax Prison campaign or website or whatever. It just strikes me as a very good sort of model, because I think people get so, it becomes very fragmented. It's all tied together, and yet it's so hard because, you know, there's you know, this community suffering, the immigrant community. Then there's people suffering in small towns, say, because there's no jobs and there's drug problems. And then, you know, they're put away on, you know, drug charges. Then there's Native Americans who are some of them political prisoners. And then you have people with their sort of separate kind of passion and interests, and somehow or another it seems like people need to come together.
Absolutely.
Somehow. From all these different communities, and basically say, like, you could just imagine the Supermax prisons and say, like, who are they? You know, our fellow citizens, neighbors, you know, community members. And it would be very, I think, maybe mind-blowing to some people to find out who's locked up in there. I'm just, like, kind of grappling with it as a poet and a writer, but, I mean, lately it's just, like, you know, great creative flow is coming to me because I just hear about these cases and I just can't believe it's happening. I mean, I'm not naive. I know this has happened, you know, before. You know, we have a long history of locking people up, and yet we've made some great progress in the last 40 years, and then we've seen it, you know, slide back and taken away, and now it's such a moment, it seems, of intensity that I really do, and I do think people would respond if things were kind of framed in a way that it wasn't so fragmented. You know, everybody has to go through the airport and is confronted with this nonsense. I think people know in their gut that it's just nonsense what that atmosphere is in there, or all of the cameras on the street, or not being allowed to do this or that. I think there's a great, you know, feeling that people want to break out of where we are. So I'm going to keep thinking about this, and I'm definitely going to check out this.
I was at a conference in Albany about a month ago, of a lot of grassroots prison groups, prison justice groups in New York State, exactly because we wanted to have more of an impact. And it hasn't happened yet, but I'm hoping that we're going to come out with some kind of really mass campaign that says something like, let them out. Fewer people in prisons, more back in our community. Something in California that happened a few years ago, there was a meeting of all, because of exactly what you're saying. There's so many different groups working on different parts of the issues. And unfortunately, there are many, many issues that demand attention. And they came out with some kind of, you know, it's California, so the language is like different. It was like decarceration or something like that. And then that started to be a slogan at all kinds of demonstrations that weren't about that. And the idea to me is break down the walls. Even the only way we're going to deal with this is if we break down the walls in advance and people stop seeing prisons as something other. And part of the reason they're in those rural communities is because then the people who would be active in New York don't think about prisoners. They're hundreds of miles away. You know, they're locked up behind walls. You can't see them. You can't hear them.
One more thing I'd like to, might as well just keep the mic down. One of the things I wanted to add on is, mention regarding, you know, is a concept by I think brother Eddie Ellis. He was also somebody who was incarcerated for a long time, was part of the Black Panther Party during the Attica Rebellion. There's a concept called that there's no prison problems, there's community problems. Meaning that, you know, it's not necessarily what happens in the prison that it's not in a vacuum what happens in the prison. What happens in the prison directly affects what happens in the communities. And it happens many times right under our eyes because we don't care. We pay attention or we allow ourselves to be distracted by a lot of the spin and language that the media gives us and feeds to us. You know, there's a, I read somewhere that says that the media doesn't necessarily tell us how to think. It also tells us what to think. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the language that's on our tongues, you know, the war on terror, the war on this, the war on this, that's what the media gave us, and we use it. You know, there's a lot of prison problems. It's not prison problems, it's community problems. And to make it more real, is a person who called into the organization a couple weeks ago, and his situation is that he was arrested in 1998 for marijuana charge, right? Didn't serve any time, had a $90 fine. Maybe 5 years later, I think he had the same marijuana charge, $25 fine, never served any time. In the time he was married, 3 children. His wife was petitioning for him to have his status, he gets green card and things like that, so he'd become a resident of a legal resident of America. Well, his wife got a notice in the mail early last year, stating that, you know, come down to Federal Plaza, tell your husband to come along with you, you know, bring your documents that you have so that we can, you know, continue this process. So she's happy, you know, she said, we're going to take the kids, we're almost there, you're going to get your paperwork, you're going to be legal in this country, you get your green card. It was like a celebratory event for her and her, for the family. When they go there, he's detained in front of his children, right there and then, right in front of his 3 children. So this event, this day when it's supposed to be a good event, like we're finally going to become, you know, get our status in this country, in a sense they tricked him, they cajoled him, they manipulated him to thinking that, and then, you know, he was taken away from his country right in front of him, right? And now this man is now out of this country. Without his children, his wife and children who are still in this country, you know, she has to work 2 jobs, they live in somewhere in a basement in Queens illegally because they can't afford, you know, took a breadwinner out the household. So there you have it, it's not necessarily a prison problem. It's a community problem because this man was put in detention, which is prison. But it's not only a prison. It doesn't affect just people in prison. It affected his community. You understand? And a community of not only people who are, because the people in your family aren't necessarily people who committed the crimes. They're not the people who are here illegally. They're not the people who may have did anything wrong. But they're affected by what happens to that person in detention. I think as the lady mentioned over there also that, you know, it needs to be a coalescence of people who have these different issues because they all affect each other. They're all interrelated. You know, it's just not one, there's no vacuum of these issues, of these problems, because these people, as I mentioned earlier, who enact these laws and these different things, they don't think in a vacuum either.
Yeah. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hi, I
thank you for speaking. You all are great. One of the most challenging, and I know I'm talking to organizers, one of the most challenging things I find is this very pervasive notion that we have in our society. I call it the law and order notion. You know, where we really are like, you know, maybe the people outside this room, maybe a lot of people in this room, really think that the criminal justice system or the war on terror are very sort of, they're acceptable ways that we sort of, you know, regulate bad behavior. And we really think that, you know, how the cops and the prosecutors act on Law and Order, the TV show, is how it actually happens in real life. And I guess, you know, I'm really wondering sort of in terms of overcoming, you know, everybody here has really done an amazing job of nuancing this conversation and like really busting some of those myths. But, you know, when we go out in the world, we sort of still come up against a lot of really ignorant notions that are fed to us by the media and that we buy into. So I'm wondering, like, just to hear from you, like, how do we make that, how do we drive that point home? How do we keep busting those myths? Like, you know, that's, you know, small question.
Mm-hmm. The media thing, I think the easiest thing anybody can do, we all have computers, some sort of access to the internet. When you see these things, when people use certain language, even as, you know, as prisoners, parolee, or as a terrorist, I think it's our, we have the opportunity to immediately address that. Whether it be by writing to the person that wrote that that particular article or who made that comment on the news, what have you, immediately address that language because it's the language in itself that manipulates our thinking. Because when you don't think, when you just have a label on someone, first of all, it makes it easier just to throw them away and not care about them. But when you mention like Hashim, you know this person now. You mentioned his name. You know he has a sister-in-law. You know he has a family. You understand? So now it's not so easy just to throw him away because you know his name now. You know he's a person that lives and breathes. when these people use these terms just to label people, I think that's the first thing, to not allow these labels. Don't let them get away with it. Don't let them get away with the labeling of people, because it impersonalizes the issue. It makes it, and in a sense, it makes it easier for us too. Because if it's not personal to me, then I don't really have to do anything about it. I don't have to care about it, because it's not me, it's not my brother, it's not my sister, it's not my wife, not my husband, not my friend. But when you personalize the issue, it impels you to do something. It becomes incumbent upon you to do something. Your conscience won't allow it. And also, so as you mentioned, Ms. Janice, that I think that's one of the things. That's just my thing. Is just not to allow the spin in the media to just go over your eyes. Because that's what I always say. The media is like the fourth branch of government, but it has no checks and balances on it.
Right.
Well, just to follow up with that. Also, one of the things that you can do is also start like breaking down like, well, how does locking somebody up in a cage address any of the root causes as to why people go to prison? You know, how does it address violence? How does it address trauma? How does it address poverty? How does it address racism? How does it address, you know, sexism or homophobia? How does it address any of these, you know, huge issues? And how does it address what caused that person to do what he or she did, if he or she did anything that caused them, you know, that caused somebody to decide that they should be locked up in a cage? It doesn't. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't prevent somebody else from doing something under those same circumstances to be locked up in a cage. Like, as I said in the beginning, we've got more than 2.3 million people in prison. And so, like, obviously there's something wrong in the larger society. It's not that 2.3 million people are in, you know, did bad things and need to be, like, locked away. One of the interesting things is that in 1973, when Nixon declared, you know, expanded the war on crime, crime was actually dropping. And there were actually, like, studies and national crime commissions actually stating that prison should be used as a last resort. So even way back then, these official commissions were saying, prisons aren't addressing any of the issues surrounding, you know, surrounding why people commit crimes, why people end up in prison, why people, you know, like steal or, you know, assault each other, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that I do, you know, is that I start breaking down these questions. Like, well, why do you think this person did this? Why do you, you know, like, you know, does locking them up in a cage actually prevent, you know, address any of these issues? And maybe that's because I have a 9-year-old, you know, so this is what you do when they start talking to you about, like, well, you know, we need prisons. And it's like, well, why? You know, like, it's like you start breaking it down. And maybe you don't talk to, like, a 29-year-old like you do to a 9-year-old, because then they get mad and they stop listening. But, you know, like, you start talking to them, you know, and you start breaking down these issues, and you go through those layers of, you know, like, of, you know, like, whatever misconceptions people have. You know, it's like if they're like, oh, but, you know, like, you know, da-da-da-da-da, this person is dangerous. It's like, well, you know, like, let's start looking at, you know, like, all these different layers of this person's life. It's not just, like, this one-dimensional flat character that did this one thing and therefore should be locked in a cage. Or, you know, 2.3 million people that did, you know, these 2.3 million bad things that and should be locked up in cages.
I would just add to that, educate yourself. And then you can, there was... Just every once in a while, I read the New York Times. I admit it; it's my guilty pleasure in the morning. And I'll see an article that makes me furious. And I always write letters; they've never printed mine. But I'll see someone who does, and it's usually, excuse the expression, a professor, and they have facts. And so they bust whatever the myth is out of the water. So I'm glad you asked about where are the prisons and what's the impact on the community. That's the kind of thing that we all need to learn, so that then when someone says something, you know, you're not just sitting there going, I think that's wrong. You have really understand what's going on with the prisons so that you can respond to it.
If I
can
follow up to the question that you asked, especially in the commercial media's coverage of prison issues, if you listen to what voices are getting the most broadcast, it's very rarely folks have gone through the system themselves. And like you get to hear the voice of journalists, the law enforcement, government, people creating documentaries, filming from the outside. Sometimes there are interviews of prisoners in this really sort of limited context. But there are organizations, including in New York City, that are led partly by formerly incarcerated folks. And I think as activists who are starting to understand these issues, one thing we can do to build the movement up is make sure that those organizations led by formerly incarcerated people have our support. And get wider publicity, you know? Like, I work with a group that's part of the Correctional Association up in Harlem called the Coalition for Women Prisoners, and they make a specific point of making sure leadership in that group comes from formerly incarcerated women. And it's taught me how incredibly important that is, because you can't lead an organization in the right direction unless the folks who are in leadership have been there. And so they make the decisions, you know? And as an activist, my responsibility is to listen to them and figure out how can I broadcast this with the activist skills I bring from other places into more forums. So that's one way, I guess, we can battle the mainstream media's onslaught of coverage of prisons that's bullshit because it never actually listens to people who've been through our system.
Put your hand up.
Well, I was going to say something similar in the sense that I felt like building the leadership of people who are formerly incarcerated, what's really important is amplifying their voices as well, and that part of educating yourself is not educating yourself on sort of statistical evidence, but also learning these anecdotal stories. And if you haven't been incarcerated yourself, if you haven't been through the system yourself, then learning through the experiences of people we have, and that means engaging and supporting people who are either currently in the system right now or perhaps have found themselves outside the system or are struggling outside of it. But I do think that part of the learning process is not just being able to counter whatever diatribes are based on statistics, but also being able to personalize these issues.
I just wanted to make a we all here because we have we questioning and we basically what Laura has been saying, you know, educating yourself, what Vicky is saying, asking the right questions. But we need to take it one step further. Because sitting here saying that we're not guilty because we are not part of the wider society that causes this problem is not enough. I think you're working with Correctional Association, you're volunteering or whatever. We need to also take a step, a proactive step, take action in some way. Even if it's just to tell someone when they start the diatribe against immigrants or incarcerated people, stop, I do not accept that because of such and such, and if you want to have a discussion, we will discuss it. Or stop, if it's going to be vehement and loud, we are not going to discuss it. Because you basically end up taking a stand and you end up influencing that person because that person stops and says, why did he do that? Or why did she do that? So we need to take a step out of this room and take it out into society. And we have one person makes a difference. One person moves the world. People say you cannot change, one person cannot change the world. Jesus Christ changed the world. Muhammad changed the world. Mahatma Gandhi changed the world. Martin Luther King changed the world. So we can be that change. And even if we just change our environment, it's a step and it's a move towards changing a bigger society.
Somebody else had their hands up in the back. So I'm going to jump to them because they haven't spoken.
Kind of several of the issues, and I'm very happy for this conversation. I think that one of almost the failures of movements in general, especially like people's movements or liberation movements, that we've seen over centuries even, is that we haven't really found a way to sustainably or to sustain the parallel organizations that really need to subvert or circumscribe the powers that really put us under this oppression, and it's nonsense. I'm really happy with what you said about the communities, because it's like you know, what if in urban communities that are acutely depressed and have all these problems, if folks had a sustainable parallel institution that was able maybe to engage better in education, or you know, what if we had more local food or local employment. I mean, all these different resources that are necessary and in their absence drive people to commit what has been defined as a crime by the state. You know, we could go around that, but it's very difficult for us to have actually created something that's efficient and sustainable. Like, even when I think about planes, why is it so much that we have to rely on
claims is because we don't have a form of transportation that's either effective or efficient that doesn't have to be controlled by the state as well as by corporations. I mean, like we really and at the same time linking all of these up, we really have to figure out what's wrong with our networking process and what is the reason why, as Ms. Whiteburn said, people aren't out in the streets and there isn't this amount of folks at this like peak of oppression and I mean just of corporate control of the world. Why we need to get it up to that point, and I think that's something that we need to critique or question and figure out how we can get all the folks together so that all of these folks actually come together and we develop those parallel institutions that will create the new world that we all hoping for.
Any more questions? One last one, and then we'll wrap it up because it's getting late, and we'll be here for a little bit.
There's one question, but at the same time, I'd like to make some statement. Like, I think you have to, we have to try to understand what's going on in the U.S., but I think this is very clear that this problem is about state, all kinds of state, they have this operation, China and Russia, all kind of systems have one state, they have this kind of thing. So I think it's very important because the capitalism, the imperialism is become very, very global. We must see the things very global, how this is evolved, you know? And like in Mexico state and also. But I think it's very clear that American state has become very fascist because of the economic crisis. So, Every day, but anyway, I don't know if I agree about it. Someone said to me, the U.S. is building more prison than house. This is true. If this is true, how I can have this, how I can find this information? Because I think this is good for work with the people outside, you know, to educate people. If they have government, building more prison than house, like I.
And I just want to repeat what Jean said. People should read Christian Parenti's book because it's a good basis for that. And then a lot of this information can be found on the internet. If you want to see where New York State prisons are, you go to New York State Department of Corrections, and there they all are. And they each have a map. You click on the map, you can see where they're, you know, that all this stuff is available. They're not ashamed of it. They're proud of it, so.
Yeah, but I think education is
Right. Actually, you could, I don't know if Vicky was going to address this now, but you can actually check our websites out. Familiesoffreedom.org. That's familiesforfreedom.org. newsanctuarycoalition.org. You have Detention Watch Network. They would give you a list of all the immigrant jails, detention centers. We have mapped that out, so if you're looking for immigrant detention centers, you can go to Detention Watch Network website. I'm not sure if it's .org or if it's dwn.org, so just Google that.
Detentionwatch.org.
And from there, they will be referred to other links that will give you the information that you need to continue to educate yourself on immigrant issues and on intention and on the problems. Because this is the impending problem right now, and the immigrants are being used as scapegoats.
Just one more thing. We do have postcards in the back. If people feel like they can sign a postcard and to send to the Attorney General this week, just so that would be great. Brian is passing out the postcards, and we do have extra ones. So if you know other people that might want to sign them, again, we need to mail them in the next week or two to sort of show Holder that we're sort of watching this.
And explain why you send. If you're giving it to someone, explain why you're doing it. So
yes.
They get a history of the.
We have some fact sheets and things.
Absolutely. Over there.
And giving your name and address, that's something you feel comfortable in demanding a response from Attorney General Holder and you're comfortable giving your address. That's why that space is there. If you're not comfortable giving your address, you can just sign it.
Right. Well, thank you all for coming. We'll all be here for a little bit if you have any questions. And there are copies of The War Before and then my book about resistance and organizing in women's prisons for sale at the counter. There are many other books here. When you're done with them, Jess, that this woman in the striped shirt here, raise your hand, Jess, and I do a Books Through Bars program. So when you have books that you don't want anymore, you can send them to people in prison. So I have flyers here and I'm going to leave them at the counter if people are looking to clear their bookshelves.